From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, top stories in the news and in sports with the Sacramento Bee's Marcus Bertone, plus advice columnist Joey Garcia. But first, an update on the Delta. As you probably know, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta faces many problems, including threatened fish and fragile levees. Organizations with a vested interest in the Delta, including the state and federal governments, water districts, environmental groups, farmers, and so on, have been trying for years to come up with a plan to fix these complicated and sometimes conflicting problems. Today in Insight, we're going to take a look at two possible parts of a plan, although both are controversial. A little later, we'll talk about a proposed canal, either through or around the Delta. But first, a proposal to build gates in two Delta channels. When closed, they would stop fish being sucked into huge water export pumps. We have a variety of guests to talk about these two matters. We'll start with Michelle Denning, Regional Planning Officer for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Michelle, welcome.
Good morning.
The plan, as I understand it, is that the Bureau would operate these gates.
At this point, we haven't decided exactly what the partnership will be on constructing, owning, operating the proposal that Metropolitan Water District and the San Luis Delta Mendota Water Authority have presented to us.
Give us an idea, though, what this would involve if it happens. When we talk about gates in the Delta, what does that mean?
What these gates are they're pivot gates that would be constructed on top of a barge that then would be sunk down into the bottom of the channel. There's many construction details, but basically they're designed to manage the movement of water of higher turbidity to keep that higher turbid water away from the pumps and to see if that would keep the Delta smelt from moving closer towards the pumps.
The Delta smelt being a fish that is threatened, and some of those fish, as I understand, are sucked into the pumps at some times of the year.
Yes, the pumps do affect the water movement, and the smelt do move along with that, and they become entrained in the state and federal pumps in the Delta.
I'm guessing these gates would be quite large.
They would cross two channels, Connection Slough and I have to remember the other slough here, but
well, two sloughs
Old
in
River
the
and Connection Slough. The gates themselves would cover about half the channel. The rest would be some other mechanism, probably sheet pile.
You mentioned the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which is the main proponent of this, and the district's assistant general manager, Roger Patterson, is on the phone. Roger, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you.
Why does the Metropolitan Water District want these gates built in the Delta? What would be the benefit for your constituents in Southern California?
Well, as you mentioned in the lead-in, we all have tremendous challenges with the Delta and the ecosystem and the moving of water through the Delta. And we've done a lot of scientific-based work that's basically identified these two locations for if you could install temporary removable gates that would only be closed a portion of the time, that it would help by managing flow. It would help with the management of turbidity in the Delta. And what we have found is that the Delta smelt, which is an endangered fish, likes to maintain itself in the more turbid waters in the Delta. And thus, if we can help manage turbidity and keep it away from these channels that lead to the pumps, you would be protecting the Delta smelt and keeping them in a safer part of the Delta, if you will, and that would improve the survivability of smelt, and the result of that is then there would be less conflict with our water supplies. And so we think we've basically put the idea out as a demonstration program to take a look at if these temporary removable gates could help us in the overall management, combined with some more sophisticated modeling work that we've done that we think could be more predictive of how Delta smelt are moving and give us some tools that we could use, at least in the short term, to improve situation for both smelt and water supplies.
So this would be a demonstration project. In other words, if it works, it could be expanded to other places.
It could. I mean, the notion, as Michelle said, that these are gates. They're not very sophisticated gates. They're built on a barge, and you could move them to any of the small channels in the delta and essentially sink them to the bottom of the channel and see if you could get some benefits of those. And if it's not providing the benefit you want in one location, you could certainly give it a try someplace else. One of the things that we would like to see is a very in-depth monitoring program associated with these, including, you know, new technologies such as high-speed cameras underwater to see, see what's going on and actually learn as we go forward and try to get some benefits, but basically to advance the scientific knowledge of what's happening in the Delta, which is a major challenge.
Is someone else doing something like this elsewhere that you heard about and that's what gave you all the idea to do this?
You know, where we sort of tumbled to this might be worth looking at is as we were working with Department of Water Resources on emergency preparedness plans in the Delta. There was a lot of talk 3 years ago about what would happen to parts of the Delta in a major seismic event. And what we learned is that these islands are very fragile, and a 6.5 earthquake would cause up to 50 major levee breaches in the Delta, and as a result, suck salinity in from the bay, and the Delta essentially would become a saline area that would not work for moving water supplies to 25 million plus Californians. And so we started looking at, could we pre-position rock or other materials in the Delta so that in an event, rather than be out of business for moving water for up to 3 years, we could patch things back together more quickly. And we found there were certain locations in the Delta that were more sensitive to this than others, and that's where we proposed stockpiling material. And then we also thought, let's take a look at that from just in normal times managing turbidity, and that's sort of how we got to this idea that seems to have some merit.
Roger Patterson of the Metropolitan Water District. In our studio is Charlotte Hoddy, Water Program Manager with the Planning and Conservation League. Charlotte, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you make of this proposal to build gates in the Delta to try and stop smelt being sucked into water pumps?
Well, Jeffrey, it is an experiment intended to divulge more information about what are the impacts really affecting the behavior of Delta smelt. And that's a good thing because, as Roger mentioned, a scientific understanding of how to avoid extinction of these plummeting species has really been a challenge in the Delta. But experiments can go terribly wrong. So doing any shortcuts in the environmental review would really be a mistake in the hopes that nothing would go wrong.
So at this point, you're not opposed to it, but you have a skeptical eye on it.
Well, we're just really hoping that the environmental review is as stringent as it would be for any proposed project that wasn't just a demonstration.
Also with us is Keith Coolidge, Chief Deputy Director for the CalFed Bay Delta Program at the California Natural Resources Agency. Keith, welcome.
Morning, Jeffrey.
What does the state of California make of this idea to build gates in the Delta?
Well, we think this is potentially a really promising project and are supportive. We are also helping particularly CalFed Science Program tomorrow with a science review. A panel of national experts convene. We're going to start at 9 and run all day to examine the project, look at particularly some of the concerns on how do we do adequate monitoring to make sure that this does work the way it's intended.
When would it start? When would the construction start? Maybe Michelle Denning can help us with that.
Well, right now, reclamation, the Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, Department of Water Resources, also Metropolitan Water District and the San Luis Delta Mendota Water Authority are moving forward very quickly, very focused on the permitting process right now to get do the environmental review process, the consultation for endangered species, and to get the permits. Project proponents would really like to install these structures this fall if possible so that we could start the experiments next year. But we're going through all the processes that are normally required at an expedited schedule or prioritized schedule now.
And how long do you think the experiment would take? A year?
We're planning on it to permit it for 5 years to include through the permitting process the removal of the structure.
One other guest joins us for our extended Delta discussion, Barbara Barragan-Paria, Campaign Director of Restore the Delta. Barbara, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
What's your organization's position on these gates?
Well, one of the overall problems in the Delta is that whenever we make geographical changes, you end up altering hydrology. And we do not know, really, if it is a good project or not. I'm nervous, when we're nervous about the expedited schedule that was just mentioned. We believe that if this is a good experiment and potentially a good project, then it should be vetted through a normal environmental review process. We're also concerned and want to make sure that the science going forward really looks at the impact on all fisheries, not just Delta smelt, because we have such declining numbers in all the fisheries within the Delta.
Michelle Denning, just again, since two people have mentioned this issue, would it be a quote-unquote normal environmental review process?
At this point, the only thing that you might say is out of the ordinary is that all the agencies have elevated the permitting process to one of their highest priorities to work on. They prioritize their staff's efforts on it. And that is one of the things that leads to many of the longer time frames to complete the permitting process. But every required step will be made, and every required time frame for public review for each of the permitting agencies will be complied with.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we'll turn to the proposed peripheral canal that's planned for the Delta. We'll continue with the same guests. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. We're continuing our discussion of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and two plans to perhaps deal with some of its problems. Earlier, we talked about the proposal to build two gates in the Delta to stop fish being sucked into huge water export pumps. An experiment is likely about to start. Now we're going to talk about a peripheral canal or canals that could be built through or around the Delta. This issue has been talked about on and off for decades, and there's opposition to it from people who live or work in the Delta and from environmental groups. But the state of California seems to be moving toward building the canal. This summer, engineers are taking soil samples to help decide what route or routes the canal should take. We'll continue our discussion with the guests you've already met. Keith Coolidge, Chief Deputy Director for the CalFed Bay Delta Program. What is the status of the canal? To what extent is the state of California moving forward on it?
Thank you, Jeffrey. The idea of moving water around the Delta and potentially through it has, as you said, been around for a long, long time. It was part of the CalFed program early on. Its evaluations, it's been part of what is now the Bay Delta Conservation Plan development, looking at strategies to restore the Delta as well as maintain a reliable water supply. It has been part of recommendations from the governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force, Delta Vision, as a way to separate these water supply conveyance facilities from the ecosystem so that both can thrive. The idea of a canal is being evaluated through an environmental review process that the Department of Water Resources has begun. It is being discussed within the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. And both of them, most recently part of coming out of the scoping sessions, a recommendation that they evaluate a tunnel instead of just a surface canal on both of the eastern and western alignments. It might be less invasive, less disruptive to both the environment and the Delta itself.
Has a decision been made, overtly or not, to build some kind of conveyance, whether it's a canal or canals or a tunnel, through or around the Delta?
That will depend on the evaluation, the environmental evaluation going on. No decisions have been made.
Charlotte Hoddy at the Planning and Conservation League, what do you make of the talk of building a canal or a tunnel?
Well, yesterday the legislature released a five-bill package. This is a package dealing with Delta. And it really is a game-changing legislation, and it changes the conversation as we've had it so far. The legislation would grant a politically appointed council to have sole authority to decide whether it was a canal bringing water around the delta or a tunnel burying it under the delta. And they would also decide how much Californians would have to pay. And I think the take-home message is that the manner in which these proposals are being jammed through defies public interest at a time when the public is really most interested in how the government is spending their resources.
Well, what kind of process would you rather see?
Well, what we want is, I think the public and the legislature needs to know what it is we're buying, how it's going to work, how much it's going to cost, and who's going to pay for it before the decision is placed solely in this council that's embodied in the legislation.
Keith Coolidge, can you comment on Charlotte Hardy's criticisms of how the state of California is moving, at least the legislature, on this?
Well, I'm not going to criticize the legislature. In fact, we look forward to working through the remainder of the legislative session to further refine the package of bills that they put out yesterday. I think that the one constant which has been a discussion for several years is that the facilities for the canal would be paid for not by the taxpayers but by the water contractors, the beneficiaries in this case, and they have agreed to that concept. The additional work, restoration in the delta, not directly related to the canal, would be part of the other package.
Charlotte, your criticism there was of the process, not of the potential product. What about the notion of building a canal or a tunnel? Setting aside how it happens, what do you make of that?
Well, it could potentially be a good project. And I think that the process has a lot to do with whether it is a good project. There's potentially large consequences for the California's pocketbook and for the Delta itself. And so the process to weed those consequences out early on before we make a decision and before we define how we will make that decision after legislation is passed is really important. Two-thirds of California receives water from the Delta. So those are all beneficiaries. And so even in a beneficiary pay system, all those people will see that on their water bill.
Roger Patterson, Assistant General Manager of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Southern California water users are key beneficiaries, if you want, of the water in the Delta. What does your district make of the idea of building a canal or a tunnel and the process that the state of California is going through?
Well, we've been pushing for a long time to move ahead with some kind of a comprehensive solution that'll deal with all of the problems that we see in the Delta. I think a canal of some fashion is a piece of that solution. I think Charlotte's right. It's not just the facility, but key is how does that facility, how is it operated to make sure that we are maintaining the kinds of flows we need in the Delta for its future, in addition to providing reliable water supplies to those that are looking to that. And I think, you know, we've had now the Public Policy Institute of California, we've had the UC Davis folks, we've had the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and the three fishery agencies, both state and federal. We're seeing more and more people recognizing that a canal is probably part of the solution, but it's a part of an overall more comprehensive package, I think. And we're interested in moving that ahead through a process, a public process, to make those kinds of decisions. We know that it's expensive. I think we know that our constituents will be looked to pay a large portion of the cost, and we're prepared to do that. But we also want to make sure that it's something that's going to work for the long term for us as well as the Delta, and that it goes through the right kind of an analysis. But we are in a crisis, and so we want to keep the process moving and have that discussion.
Barbara Barragan-Perea of Restore the Delta, the proposed canal is a big issue for your organization. What do you make of the way things stand right now as the state of California explores whether or not to build a canal or a tunnel?
Well, we have two thoughts that immediately come to mind. First off, We keep talking about a project that's going to happen that really doesn't have a description. We move 1 week from a proposal for a 50-mile-long canal to the next week for a tunnel. It's almost as if we're being presented with the proposal of the week. But what we're most concerned about is, first off, a 50-mile canal is not going to generate any new water for California. It's not going to bring water to drought-stricken areas that need the water. In the proposed legislation that was released yesterday, the creation of a council that would have four appointees from the state, one from the Senate, one from the Assembly, and only one representative from the Delta would mean that the Delta would be shut over the out of the oversight process for any movement towards creating this project. And basically, authority for water management in California and costs, including mitigation costs, for any environmental impacts would be handed over to faceless bureaucrats.
Keith Coolidge, Barbara just said that a canal would not generate new water. It would just be siphoning off water at a different part of the process. Is that a problem?
No, that's actually part of the solution. By moving a diversion point from a dead end at the south of the Delta to potentially an on-stream flow, it has great benefit to the way we can mitigate fish entrainment.
You said earlier that it would benefit the ecosystem of the Delta to have this canal or tunnel because it would separate the water that's going to Southern California and the San Joaquin Valley from the water that the fish need. How can an ecosystem do better if you take some of the water out earlier?
Well, the art is in determining, as Roger talked about, the flows that need to be in the Delta, the ability to take water above and beyond those flows for diversion. Part of the issue is that water that is good for the ecosystem is high in organics and potentially has variable salinity. Water that is good for drinking water for export has low organics and low salinity, and that's why you'd move that. The art will be in how much flows do you leave in the Delta, how do you restore the Delta so that the ecosystem is vibrant with the right amount of water.
Michelle Denning at the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, does the Bureau have a position on this?
Oh, we support the studies. We're participants with DWR and again, do want to go through the most effective public process and disclosure and bring in all the right information. But absolutely, we are interested in improving the reliability of the water supplies that we deliver through the Delta to the San Joaquin farmers and other places.
Charlotte Hardy, would the Planning and Conservation League just like to see the process changed towards perhaps building a canal or a tunnel, or would the Planning and Conservation League really just like to see no canal or tunnel?
We really are concentrating on the process because I think that is what we're going to, just like the two gates, bringing science up front and making sure all these consequences are vetted very early with enough public review, which they will start, the legislature will start that on the 18th, and we're happy to see that process move forward.
Do you have a standing policy, though, on a canal or tunnel?
We don't at this point. We actually are just trying to concentrate, as I said, on that process.
And finally, Keith Coolidge at CalFed Bay Delta Program, what's the timeline here for this study work on a possible canal or tunnel?
The timeline is to have a draft environmental review, EIR, EIS, ready by the end of this year and go through an environmental review process next year.
I see. Well, thank you all so much. Our guests on the phone, Barbara Barragan-Paria, Campaign Director of Restore the Delta, and Roger Patterson, Assistant General Manager of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. In our studio, Michelle Denning, Regional Planning Officer for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, Charlotte Hardy, Water Program Manager with the Planning and Conservation League, and Keith Coolidge, Chief Deputy Director for the CalFed Bay Delta Program at the California Natural Resources Agency. We've been talking about two proposals for helping to mitigate problems in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Insight listeners, we have covered this topic many times over the years. We've posted links to previous discussions on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the top stories in the news with columnist Marcus Bertone. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what and why at insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow, an Insight from Attic to Archives, a new exhibit at UC Davis about some interesting historical collections that people happened upon in their attic. Also in our weekly music feature, Sound Advice, classical music host Michael Frost plays music in honor of a man who recently passed away and left Michael his classical record collection. Time now to check in with Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. He joins us the first Wednesday of each month to talk about some of the top stories in the news and sports. Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you.
One headline in the paper today reads, Sheriff Surprise, no bid for second term. But across the same page in your column, you wrote, it was just a matter of time. Why is Sacramento County Sheriff John McGinnis not going to run for a second term?
Well, being an opinion columnist, it's my opinion, because the sheriff, being a positive guy, certainly is trying to put a positive spin on it. My feeling about it, with sort of reading between the lines, is that I think that he just had enough. I think that...
It's been a tough few months.
Tough couple of years. The budget is a mess. His staff has been gutted. Rampant layoffs. He was just completely shut out of millions of dollars in federal funding that the Sacramento Police Department will enjoy now, but his sheriff department applied as well, and they didn't get anything. He had a very public fight with the county executive. It goes on and on and on. And I think that not getting the money, that was just the last straw. He did look at an assembly run because Roger Nilo, a fellow Republican, is being termed out, and that would have been a natural fit for him. He's a great communicator, but I just don't think he's got the passion for it. And he's going to step aside, and it opens up a really interesting possibility of who's going to run first. Because it being Sacramento, the seat is still warm, and there are other people trying to sit in it. So that's just the way it is here, and that's where we're headed.
Yeah, before it had actually been officially announced that he wasn't going to run for another term, at least one candidate had thrown his hat in the ring.
And I was sort of teasing with the sheriff, and I put it in the column that, you know, he was informing his senior staff yesterday, and the meeting wasn't even concluded yet, and the word was out. But Sacramento, that's the way it is. It's one of the reasons I love working here. Captain Jim Cooper, who's on the Elk Grove City Council, has taken out papers to run. I'm sure there'll be others, including potentially Al Najera, who was the police chief of Sacramento. And before Najera retired last year, had spoken publicly about his desire to someday run for sheriff. And when I reached him by phone yesterday, he sure talked like somebody who was going to throw his hat in the ring. So it should make for a really interesting race, because you have law enforcement leaders who are running for elective office, and it's an unusual dynamic and one that not everyone loves, but that's where we are.
At least one of the problems that Sheriff McGinnis faced was self-inflicted by his department because of a miscalculation about cost savings, and they had to lay off more deputies than they thought. But setting that aside, the economy, the sheriff can't control that, and he doesn't determine where federal stimulus money goes. Who would want this job?
Well, I think a number of people will. I think it's a job that burns people out. This being Sacramento, there's no shortage of why don't we say self-confident people who are always aspiring to something. Now, you look at someone like former Chief Najera. He's working in the private sector now. He's working for a computer company that's on the cutting edge of technology. Very unusual job for someone of his caliber, and I'm sure he's very well compensated for the job, on top of, I'm sure, his very generous pension. And yet, you know, he feels the itch. These types of jobs attract people like that. The making the money isn't enough. They, as Richard Nixon used to say, they were in the arena, and I think that it attracts that type of person. Now, once they get in the job, they probably ask themselves, "Why the hell did I do this?" But the pursuit is something that is very attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, and unlike a certain Alaska governor, Sheriff McGinnis is at least staying in
he's
office.
At least staying. You know, we have these knucklehead people who comment sometimes on the Bee website, and knucklehead is the correct word to use. And, you know, so there was a few of them who were comparing him to Palin. He's finishing his term. Thank you very much. And look, I mean, you can't lead a department with a $400 million budget and have so many laughs and not be held in low esteem by some people. And he certainly has. There was a lot of chatter leading up to it, all off the record, of course, about that he wasn't going to last. So it wasn't a surprise in that sense. But I think that when it's all said and done, he's going to be seen as a good public servant.
And I don't think you'd confuse John McGuinness and Sarah Palin,
no,
a Vanity Fair photograph them,
no,
in the in a dock in
Alaska. John's a handsome man, but no, in his own way, we'll put it that way, in his own way, but no, you wouldn't confuse the two of them. They're both Republican, that's about it.
Marcus Breton, Sacramento Bee columnist. His column appears Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper's Our Region section. Your previous column before today's had an ironic reflection on Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson, who's working hard, pushing a ballot initiative that, mm-hmm, would give his office more powers, and yet you say he'd be better off the way it is.
It is an interesting, interesting dynamic at work in that you have a person who's starting to really grow into the job that he has, that in many ways he's built for. The Sacramento mayor's job, as is currently written, is, I wouldn't say more ceremonial, but there can be very ceremonial aspects to the job. At the end of the day, you're only one vote on the council. You don't have a line item veto. You don't have any veto. The operational aspects of the job are handled by the city manager. And what you have is the bully pulpit. And he's great at using that. And he's very shrewd at using his celebrity as an NBA All-Star to get in the door, as it were, with the President of the United States. And in this case, with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, who was the governor of Arizona. He was an all-star with the Phoenix Suns. They go back a long ways. And when they went in the room with the chief of police, as is related to me, the first 45 minutes of this meeting were catching up on the old days. And that's those sort of relationships he can bring to bear, going on CNN and NBC News. So he's great at those things. He wants more. He wants to hold the reins and control the city. And the point that I try to make in the column is that it's tough to separate the individual, Kevin Johnson, from the issue of changing how Sacramento works. And what we know about his record as someone who runs things is pretty dismal with St. Hope schools and the number of, I mean, we could fill up an entire hour with the number of problems they've had. and yet he wants to run it. And so it's making a lot of people very nervous. But it's a good, healthy discussion for the city to have, but it's hard to separate this particular guy from the issue at hand.
Now, it's the city council that decides whether this ballot initiative, which has qualified for the ballot,
right,
whether it goes before voters in 2010 or 2012.
Or any time, really. I mean, that's
true. Right. But 12 would be when Johnson has to run again for mayor.
Right.
What do you think? Do you think the council should put it on the ballot at the first available opportunity, or should they wait until what would appear to be a politically more heated time?
Yeah. You know, in this, I will acknowledge that there's a flaw in my argument, because I sort of advocate for 2012. But then I thought about it and I thought, well, look, you know, he collected the signatures, so why not put it on the ballot in 2010? So that becomes a political issue for him. He has to get the votes. And at the end of the day, that's what the job is about. You have to get the votes. He may do that. He may get the votes. Sitting here right now, and I've been furiously making phone calls all over town, he may have the 5 votes.
Really?
He may have it. He may not. We won't know until tomorrow night. But he may have the votes. And if he has the votes, God bless him. Put it on 2010. That's what he wants. And if he's skillful enough to get the 5 votes, he's gotten the signatures, why not do it? My argument about 2012 was he was elected under one set of rules. Why not finish that term and then make the argument? But this is a guy who doesn't want to wait. And if I'm true to my word, then I'm true to my word. If I used to criticize Heather Fargo for not being able to get the votes, not being able to get things done, and I did, then if this guy can get the votes and get things done, then I should just shut up, and then he should, if he can do it, then God bless him.
Marcus Breton, Sacramento Bee columnist. Let's turn to sports now. Your former colleague, Nick Peters, recently won the Baseball Hall of Fame's Writers Award, the Baseball Writers Award, and he was honored on July 26th at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And I listened to that. It was quite an emotional talk that he gave. It was hard for him, I guess, to be standing up there in the spotlight.
I don't know how he did it. And I watched the video as well. And imagine being an old school baseball writer where you covered baseball. When you first got into covering baseball, not every team had an African-American player. At that point, desegregation had not completely come to baseball. You covered it from that point to the steroids era and everything in between. And then all of a sudden you find yourself standing on a dais. Behind you is a wall of the greatest players who ever played. I don't know how he did it. I would have been so emotional. I don't think that I could have gotten the words out, but Nick was able to do it, and it was a wonderful moment for him and really for people like him who love the game and practice the craft of writing, and it was a wonderful affirmation for him and for those of us who love the craft.
Nick Peters is a San Francisco guy. It's where he was born and raised. And at one point in his speech at the Baseball Hall of Fame, he talked about how the mixed feelings in San Francisco about the Giants arriving because it meant the demise of the San Francisco Seals. Here's Nick Peters.
Amid the excitement of having Major League Baseball, there was also sadness because we lost our beloved Seals. Curiously, that last Seals team was managed by Joe Gordon.
And that Joe Gordon was the former, the late player who was inducted into the Hall of Fame as a player, but he also, as it happens, was the manager of the San Francisco Seals and then the Sacramento Solons.
And it was, there's a wonderful heritage of baseball along the coast, the Pacific Coast League, and the Solons had a team at the Seals, Oakland. There were teams in Southern California and in San Diego, and that's that they launched the careers of Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, and so Nick saw the tail end of that as a young man, and then he was present to now when it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and he remembers Barry Bonds as a child in the Giants clubhouse, and then becoming this supernova of an athlete slash controversial figure, and Nick was present for it all. He covered baseball through the civil rights era, when cocaine was a major issue, and then all the way through free agency. He was present. He covered it, and it was a wonderful moment for him and for those of us who know him. And what I always remember about Nick Peters is 2002 World Series. The Giants are six outs away from winning it. And all these people were coming up to Nick and patting him on the back. Hey, Nick, you finally got it. And Nick, ever the pro, said, "They haven't won the game yet." And sure enough, in the Giants completely crumbled. They lost the game. We all had to destroy what we had written and start all over again on deadline. Nick never said a word. He packed up his computer and left, ever the pro, and definitely Hall of Fame.
And speaking of the Giants, their home record of 37-16 is the best in the major leagues. Their road record of 22-32 is even worse than fifth place Cincinnati in the National League Central. I guess that doesn't bode well for the Giants if they happen to make the playoffs.
If they happen to make the playoffs, they definitely are a different team. Look, I mean, they definitely have exceeded expectation this year. They have great pitching. If they had any kind of offense at all, they'd be a real threat with the pitching staff they have. Just the fact that they are competitive again is so welcome because we have gone through, Northern California has gone through a stretch on the sporting scene that has been the worst of all time. I mean, there's no precedent for this. Almost every single team is horrible. And so the fact that the Giants are competing again, even though they are terribly flawed, and only the greatest optimist would actually think that they have a chance, just the fact that they're competitive again, I know I'll take it, and everybody else will take it as well.
Being thankful for small mercies.
Yes, absolutely. When your best team is in the NHL, then you're in trouble, definitely.
Marcus Bretone, Sacramento Bee columnist. His column appears Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper's Our Region section. He's on Insight the first Wednesday of the month. Marcus, thanks for joining
us. Thank
you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, advice columnist Joey Garcia will be right back.
¶¶
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's cool stuff on our Facebook page, like videos and photographs. We're at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Insight recently turned 5 years old, such a precocious youngster. We're celebrating by checking in with some of the most interesting guests who joined us on our earliest shows. Today I'm joined by Joey Garcia, who was first on Insight in early August 2004. Joey's best known to many people in Sacramento as the author of the advice column Ask Joey in the Sacramento News and Review. We'll talk about that and what else she's doing. Joey Garcia, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
When you started doing your Ask Joey column, did you think you'd be doing it after all this, after all these years? And how many years are they?
You know, it's about 13 years.
Wow.
And it has been such a privilege because I've learned so much about myself on this journey of writing this column.
What kind of questions come in most commonly? Is there a typical Ask Joey question?
A lot of them are about romantic, you know, situations, dating, or wanting to find someone. That's a huge problem for so many people.
Have things changed? Have the problems that people bring to you changed?
You know, I think in the beginning, they were a lot more what people might categorize as new age. Things around more esoteric topics, and it's become much more grounded in the realities of day-to-day life.
Why do you think it started out more New Agey, and why did it change?
I don't know, except it's very possible that that's been the energy change in Sacramento. I mean, I think when the New Age sort of situation or, you know, kind of interests and philosophies hit this area, it's like, boom, that's exciting. And then it's kind of going back to, I need more something more practical.
Yeah. How do you set about answering a question? Because we call these columns advice columns,
yes.
but advice is kind of a loaded word, and it's difficult to advise someone based on one paragraph.
And, you know, those who read the column realize that what I do is give someone a lot of options. I kind of try to peel back the first layer. In fact, there's a local psychiatrist who calls me a surgeon in the column because, I try to look for what is going on at a deeper level. What's the real spiritual, symbolic message of this particular crisis that the person believes that they're in?
You have written a book. You told me that you are hoping to sell to a publisher. What's the book about?
Oh, it's about how to communicate with teenagers. And it's filled with stories about my interactions with teenagers from the last 17 years. It's about the realities of their day-to-day lives.
And among other things, you teach at a school. You teach adolescent girls.
I do. Yes, I do. But I've also taught boys coming out of juvenile hall. I've been a mentor to homeless teens. So there's a variety of experiences in terms of the lives of teenagers. However, the issues they're stuck in go across the board.
My guest is Joey Garcia, author of the Ask Joey column in the Sacramento News and Review. You shared with me a couple of the chapters in this book that you've written. And let's just talk about one of them, Naked. It's a really striking passage.
Isn't it amazing? I love it. You know, the story is, can I tell the story?
Please do.
Yeah. I was on a date and we went over to, after the date, seeing a film at Tower Theater. We went over to Tower Books, which of course is defunct now, but to look at something we might want to buy. And while my date was wandering in the aisles, I encountered four teenage boys who had come in simply to look at pornography. And I was thinking that the clerk behind the desk was going to say stop, or the 40-something couple near them was going to say stop. And they didn't do anything. They just kind of moved away. And so I thought, I better say something. So I said, stop, put that back. You're too young to look at that. And it was so startling to me that I even said that.
Because you didn't expect to hear yourself say that.
No, it was so funny. And the power of the story for me is that the boys, you know, immediately scooted over to the door to leave. And then one turned around and swore at me. And I love the reaction I had. I said, come here. And he was terrified. And he said, what? And I said, come here right now. And they came over, all four of them, like one little unit.
That's
one
amazing,
little body.
Isn't it?
Yes. And you know, I explained that was just a word. And at some point in my life, I probably thought that about myself. And, you know, I've done a lot of personal growth work where it's something, if you swear at me, it's not going to affect me very much. So they were startled. And the youngest boy, the one in front, says, what are you, a teacher or something?
Well,
yeah, I am, I said.
And then you talk with them about pornography and what pornography really is. I mean, I like when you describe the circumstances under which women are usually photographed in magazines like Hustler, and you end up saying, what you're seeing is no longer human, which is a really striking statement.
Yeah, and they really had never thought of that before. They didn't know, you know, the different perfection. Wow, it is a kind of perfectionism in our cultures, and I'm just thinking about that, the airbrushing and the, you know, the makeup and all that. They weren't aware of that, and so they were kind of really startled to realize, oh, real women don't look like that, you know. And of course, when you discover that for some men, it's quite disappointing, and then they project that disappointment onto their female partners, which creates a whole lot of drama in relationships.
It's a great story, but the book that it's from, that you hope to have published, yes, is really about helping parents know how to speak to their children, their,
yes,
teenagers.
Parents and teachers.
What can parents and teachers take from that story that you wrote about?
Well, one of the things about the book is that in addition to the story, there's commentaries, reflections, and exercises where people can do their own personal growth work so they can remove the obstacles that would inhibit them from being real, honest, and direct with teenagers. And I think that's the biggest problem. So many times people are worried about looking perfect in front of a teenager, not revealing any of their mistakes, that kind of thing. Teenagers, you know, can see right through you. They want you to be real and honest. Parents get caught up, particularly parents get caught up, because when children are small, they look up to their parents, they adore them, they idealize them, right? They think they're mini gods. But as a child grows into a teenager, they start to see right through their parent. They see their flaws. Well, parents want the teenagers to go back to that age where they saw their parents as perfect. And teenagers aren't going to be stuffed back into that box. So that creates a lot of tension in the communication dynamic.
Another thing I take out of the story is it made me think about how a lot of parents and adults in general are kind of scared
of teenagers. Yeah.
And yet what happened with you in this circumstance, you got four teenage boys who even swore at you at one point, but by making them respect you, mm-hmm, they respected you back.
By treating them, yeah, first off, by treating them as equals to an extent. Let me explain to you. I mean, as if I encountered someone who was racist, I would want to talk with them and discuss it. And that's what I did. I discussed the situation, gave them facts, explained the problem. But I also wasn't going to be manipulated by a curse word. Right? A lot of parents are, don't talk to me like that, and the defensiveness goes up. I'm not saying I'm perfect and that I'm never defensive, but that's a place where I've done some work on myself, and I'm encouraging parents to do the same. Not to tolerate the, sure, cursing, but at the same time, not to be so crumbled by it that you're unable to continue to have a healthy conversation.
And another thing you're involved in, Joey, is your group Rise Up Belize, Advancement,
yes,
Through Education. You were born in Belize.
I was, yeah. I moved here when I was 3 years old to the Bay Area first, actually.
And what's going on in Belize that you want to help with your group?
Oh, you know, there's no free education in Belize. It's everything is tuition-based, and people are as impoverished there as in any other developing country. We tend to think of Belize as a sort of fabulous touristy spot, so they must be doing very well. But the economy there is as dismal as any other, as I said, third world country. So what we do is we offer free summer camps to the children so they can work on their academic skills over the summer. And when they complete the summer camp, they get a free backpack with all their school supplies and a package from the Sacramento Area Reading Association that allows them to continue to do activities throughout the summer. They turn that package in when school resumes, and we pay a local teacher to grade it, and we have winners. So that's one side of it. And the other side is the teachers in Belize don't have much schooling, much education themselves, so we provide professional development workshops so they can boost their skills.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, Jeffrey.
Do you go back to Belize much?
I usually go two or three times a year and see my family. I've got plenty of family still in Belize, yes.
What do your family in Belize make of who you are today and what you are?
You know, I'm not sure what you mean. They love me.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, because your life is very different from theirs. That's what I mean.
Oh, yes. You know, and I am so grateful, actually, to have been raised in this country. It is a privilege to live here, and I remember that all the time. And particularly, there's free education here and social safety nets. You know, that's astonishing. There's no welfare in Belize. So one of the things that we're going to do, actually, with Rise Up Belize is we're going to be offering relationship education. Many young women there at age 19 or 20 already have three children by three different fathers. So we're going to be taking some of what I've been doing in the column and in my high school curriculum teaching and offering that in Belize.
Well, Joey Garcia, author of the Ask Joey column in the Sacramento News and Review. She's also the author of a book that she hopes to publish, we talked about earlier, and the founder of Rise Up Belize, Advancement Through Education. That's a nonprofit group. Joey, thank you so much for joining us again today. It was nice to talk with you.
Oh, it was my joy. Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Linnea Edmire, Lynn Weaver, and Ellie Fox. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. At the board today, Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Dan Walters began writing his political column for the Sacramento Bee 25 years ago. On the next Insight, Walters tells you about his work and gives his take on the state of politics in California today. Also, a new exhibit at UC Davis highlights historical collections that people donated after discovering them in their attics. And more sound advice, the classical station's Michael Frost joins us. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.